This is the podcast of Lost in the Stacks on WREK Atlanta. Thanks for listening. If you have a moment, would you rate us or review us on whatever system you're using to listen? We would love to reach more listeners, and ratings and reviews help spread the word. Thanks.
Throughout human history, as our species has faced the frightening, terrorizing fact that we do not know who we are or where we're going in this ocean of chaos, it has been the authorities, the political, the religious, the educational authorities who attempted to comfort us by giving us order, rules, regulations, forming in our minds their view of reality.
You are listening to WREK Atlanta, and this is Lost in the Stacks, the original, not crispy, Research Library rock and roll radio show. I am Charlie. My absent co-host is Amit. We both work at the Georgia Tech Library. All right, if you're a longtime listener, you know the way the script is supposed to go, but we're going to have to deviate. Anthony is on the board, and today is Anthony's last day as a member of the Lost in the Stacks crew. Yeah, we think that stinks. He has been with us for a long time, and we have been delighted to have him here. We'll miss you, Anthony. I mean that, even though it's also written down. To celebrate your time with Lost in the Stacks, we've prepared a little send-off fanfare. Anthony, please roll the tape. Anthony is on the board.
Hey.
God. See, one day, there's going to be a fanfare, and you're just going to fall on the floor. That's going
to
happen.
I'm really looking forward to that day, though.
Man, I am, too.
Anthony is on the board.
Hey.
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 Oh, my God.
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 Hey.
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 Oh 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 my God.
Hey.
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 Please tell me that, like, that was originally like that. Like, the beat, it was on the beat the entire time. Because, like, I could see that definitely being a track.
I had to find a particular song that almost matched. And I will admit, I did maybe Audacity a little bit. But the Oh My Gods fit perfectly.
Yeah, yeah.
Fancy production value for Anthony's last show.
Exactly. Thank you.
Okay, no tears. Victor and Wendy are in the studio with us. And for the next hour, we've got music and library talk for you. Whichever you're here for, we hope you dig it.
Our show today is called Question My Authority.
Whoa.
We're going to talk about how we construct authority in scholarly publishing and how maybe that's weird to do.
How might that be weird?
Well, consider when a librarian stands in front of a class and says, "This article has all the qualities of a trustable piece of scholarship." And the class asks, "Why?" And the librarian says, "Because it is a trustable piece of scholarship." And then the class asks, "How do we know that?" And the librarian says, "Because I said so."
That sounds a little circular.
Our guest today is Liz Holdsworth, one of our GT Library colleagues. And if you, our listeners, want to join the conversation, the hashtag for this show is LITS315 for Lost in the Stacks, episode 315.
Feel free to tweet your thoughts, reactions, and authority conundrums with that hashtag.
Conundrums. Our songs today are about that uneasy tension between the authority and the learner, about doubting others and doubting oneself. Some people can manage that tension to be both a critical learner and a reliable authority figure, but for some people, it's a hard thing to judge. So let's start with some people. by the Chords 5 right here on Lost in the Stacks. That was Some People by the Chords 5 right here on Lost in the Stacks. Our show today is called Question My Authority, and I'm sure that you hear someone's voice saying that in your head. Our guest is Liz Holdsworth, the STEM librarian at the Georgia Tech Library. Welcome to the show, Liz.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Get up on that mic. Bring that mic towards you.
Okay.
There you go. Cool. So I came to you and I said, hey, what should we talk about on air? And you said we should talk about authority. And I thought, okay, this could go many ways. But when you think academic authority, what do you think of? Why is it interesting to you?
Well, because, all right, I can tie it back to my own teaching experience, where generally I've had 50 minutes to tell a crowd of 19-year-olds who don't have discipline-specific knowledge why we do academic research the way we do and why it's important to find legitimate or authoritative papers. But something that's also been my experience is the more that I dig into a discipline and how research is conducted or how that kind of plays out in the real world, authority becomes a little more nebulous or less straightforward than how I tend to teach it.
And authority in this case, we can kind of just call it correctness,
yeah,
or certainty, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is an authoritative paper on a subject. Doesn't mean that it has a nightstick and a badge, but it means that we can trust it, that mm-hmm. it is most likely true, right? Now, you've added physics to your subjects you have to teach about, right?
Right.
And has that not been a subject that you like?
No. But that's okay. I mean, I find it on the outside very interesting. So I'm just going to dig in as best I can.
Yeah. So what are you going to start looking for? Because now you have to somehow translate or communicate the authority of researchers that you are not familiar with to students who are not familiar with those researchers. So how do you start?
Well, I beg and plead to get, I beg and plead to get a little bit of background information on that class. And then I kind of teach the skills, or I do myself the skills I would teach. So I take the language that I'm unfamiliar with. I look at Wikipedia, no shame. What do those words literally mean?
Mm-hmm.
I follow the references that inform that article. And then I try to take it to the database or to a blog and see the discussion around it. And once I kind of get that background knowledge, I kind of turn it into the lesson, like smooth off the rough edges, and then hopefully bring a little bit more legitimacy to that conversation.
Do you do that classic assignment of here's a terrible article and here's a great article and tell me why?
I don't. Partially because there are some terrible articles that look really, really good. And what I tend to do is let's pick some examples from a peer-reviewed journal, a journal that we know has this particular kind of process that we value. And a couple of these articles I'm going to show you are what we would consider legitimate sources of information, something that you could cite. And then a couple of these are not going to fall into those parameters. So what does legitimacy look like versus something that there might be forthcoming studies or a pilot or something else?
And what are the kind of things that maybe look legitimate but are not?
Sometimes you will have a group of researchers. I'm thinking like of my favorite, my ringer article that I always use to throw off the group, where it's published, I believe, in The Lancet, and it's six scientists coming together to talk about diabetes and obesity in developing nations. And it has the graphs. It's got some sweet maps. It has some citations at the end. And it's 3 pages long. And every single time, they think of it as original research. It's not.
What is it?
I would call it just sort of like a really nice opinion piece. Like, we think this is important. We should look into it further. But it's not, it points to legitimacy, like good sources, but it's not in itself something that you could take forward and say, because these four guys say it's important, it's important. It's not.
Yeah. When you were talking earlier, it made me think about how instead of really saying you have to look at the article or the source or whatever it might be and divine from the source itself whether it is authoritative, you're looking at that source in context, you know, mm-hmm. like who talks about it, where is it cited, where is it discussed, where did these people come from, what was it was published in. It's much more of a where does it rest in the constellation as opposed to what qualities does it have in itself,
mm-hmm.
which sounds like it's very hard to teach.
Yes, it's a very, very difficult class to teach, especially without that domain knowledge. They don't understand the discipline yet. They don't understand how all of this is communicated yet. It's something they're going to get maybe in 2 years. So you have to give it to somebody in September in their first month of school, outside of high school.
Yeah, Fred.
Oh, so
you scared me, man.
Oh. Sorry, radio drama. I was just going to ask what, on a like broader level, what do students that are coming in their first months of school, what do they think about sources like Wikipedia? What is their view of the authority presented in that?
Most of the students, you know, when I ask them about it, I feel bad picking on them. There's three kids in the class who always say, my teacher never says to use Wikipedia and it's terrible. And
those are my kids.
Right. And my response to that is, if you know nothing, absolutely nothing, just pull the official language out of it and take it somewhere else. For the most part, they'll tell me that they don't use it or they know that it's not authoritative. But I know from my own behavior and from watching them, like peering over their shoulders, that they do something else completely
different.
They're
giving you the answer that they think you want to hear.
Yeah.
But really they use it as a authoritative source.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'll have to have you back for Wiki Does, Wiki Don't Part 2 sometime in the future. This is Lost in the Stacks. Our guest is Liz Holdsworth, a librarian here at Georgia Tech, and we'll be back with more about authority, academic or otherwise, after a music set.
File this set under PE1404.Q47.
I think I smell a rat by the White Stripes. Before that, Somewhere in the Night by Smog. And we started off with Cool Your Power by the Pain Teens. Songs about questioning the authority of others.
Today on Lost in the Stacks, we're talking about authority, teaching it, identifying it, and challenging it, with Liz Holdsworth, the STEM librarian at the Georgia Tech Library. So as we were coming into the second segment, we brought up the great big bad, the rat that we all smell,
mm-hmm.
The 1998 Andrew Wakefield et al. Article about vaccines and autism. So the MMR vaccine and autism. And I think everyone has a little bit of, what would you call it, familiarity with what was in that paper, even if it's just that now they kind of think in the back of their minds, oh, does autism, vaccines, is that connected? Can we talk about how that happened? What is that article and why is it so important?
Okay, so for me, that article is important because it was an early report in The Lancet. Lancet is one of the preeminent medical journals on the planet, just respected. It's a career builder, career maker, if you get published in The Lancet. This experiment was looking at 12 children who had various GI problems. Wakefield was a GI doctor. And then sort of making a connection between them developing these particular kind of behavioral problems with receiving the MMR vaccine. And so it was published in 1998. It was immediately controversial. Studies coming out of Japan a few years later indicating that this is just not a connection because vaccines are handled in different places.
So when you say controversial, you mean like it was immediately something that people tried to reproduce and they or tried to look at data sets to figure out if this was correct or?
I think in the sense that nobody had seen that connection before. And it's kind of a public health nightmare if there are behavioral problems associated with vaccines. Everybody has vaccines. It's, you know, polio vaccine is one of the greatest things people have ever done for public health, smallpox vaccine. And it's done, you know, on a massive scale. I remember getting vaccines before I go to school. It's like you have to have at that time, you had to have a really rock solid reason to not give your child a vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And as people were becoming more and more aware of being on the autism spectrum, there can be very serious problems associated with being on the spectrum. And of course, very difficult to manage if you're a parent with a child with those serious symptoms.
Right. So this article that came out, and the key here, right, is 12 subjects.
Right.
And like, that's not enough.
No.
Right, for any sort of conclusions. But did everything else check out on this? Why does this article look like it's the real deal and worth trusting?
Okay, so this is where my lesson completely falls apart. with the students, is if you look at it in its face, it's a peer-reviewed journal with a peer-review process. You have the 10, 13 researchers on it who are all credentialed experts. They have the nice, like, cited reference list. You can go back and look at where they got all their sources.
It's the reputation of The Lancet, too.
Right, absolutely. And they have their graphs. They have their methods. It all checks out. Looks good. If you don't have that specialist knowledge, why wouldn't it be convincing?
And the specialist knowledge being just how 12 is not enough, or?
I would say, you know, it was an early report, so maybe we've seen this in 12 kids. It merits further study.
Gotcha.
But are you a GI doctor, and the tests that they ran were appropriate for this kind of study? Where did these kids come from? Something that was a problem, you know, came out later, was Wakefield had a very serious conflict of interest with this study, which was undisclosed. So the more knowledge you have about immunology and the kinds of tests that would be necessary, and then just the research protocols, that's when you would kind of look at this and be like, I'm not so sure. But with just a little bit of knowledge, maybe not.
So is it the responsibility of the journal to prevent things like this?
Is that a leading question?
I would say so. It's hard to argue with that. I was turning this over a little bit the other day because I was thinking about the disclosure of conflict of interest, which is something that is very important in medical research that isn't always done. And it struck me as kind of strange that was on the, it seemed to be on the honor system. Like, I swear I have no conflict of interest doing this study. And maybe that should be something that is more deeply investigated independently.
Yeah, but PIs for every single article, and not primary investigators, but private eyes, that's mm-hmm. a little cost prohibitive, right?
Yeah,
you can't go digging in everybody's background.
Or even if the journal can't be responsible for that, then is it the peer reviewer's responsibility as well to sort of vet?
Right. Except mm-hmm. they're double blind. You know, a peer reviewer is not supposed to know who the person is. So there's, I mean, the again, this is back to the context. Everything about that article, even, I guess, as you said, Liz, if it's 12, hey, we started to see this, we should keep looking at it. Like, all of that seems legitimate. But the conflict of interest you were talking about, I believe, was money. Right, mm-hmm. that came to Wakefield the year before from a group, and I'm going to get this a little bit wrong, but a group of lawyers who were suing to be able to try to sell their vaccine or something like that.
Oh, it was a group of lawyers essentially looking for that class action lawsuit with the MMR vaccine.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It seems like you could land on either a a pessimistic outcome here. Optimistic. The pessimistic aspect of it would be like, okay, well, you know, this is obviously a glaring example of peer review and publishing authority failure. And, you know, that sows the seeds of distrust for anything that you see. And then the positive side of it would be like, well, this was published and it got out there. But then the fact is it got out there and then other people saw it and were able to take that action and use it and develop, you know, counter authorities of their own.
That's pretty good, Fred. But I have two answers to that. 12 years to retract the article and a measles outbreak in Disneyland.
I got nothing.
Okay, we'll be back with more on the left side of the hour.
Hello, I am Aziza Shawin.
Compliant by Shellac.
Yes.
Charlie's favorite. Before that, Pillar to Post by Aztec Camera. Songs about lack of confidence in one's own authority.
Today we're talking about academic authority with Liz Holdsworth, the STEM librarian at the Georgia Tech Library. And we left off with the beginning of the Andrew Wakefield vaccine article saga, right? And so let's continue with that a little bit more and talk about what happened. So this small study that was not really, you know, correct in its handling of the test results or the subject group, it was published. And a couple of people noticed it was weird, right? And then it just kind of dropped off, right? And then no one did anything else ever again with that article.
And the rest is history. No, it was immediately controversial. One particular journalist really dogged Wakefield, and Wakefield had to... thinking tribunals, but that's not right. Not a military tribunal. Different kinds of commissions and discussions about that particular study.
So it was reviewed again and again, and he himself had to like testify.
Essentially. Yeah. I think it was 2004. A number of the people who had been associated with that study dropped out, or recanted, disavowed, retracted their involvement with that paper, and then. In 2010, The Lancet formally and completely retracted it. And I think also in 2010, there were a couple other papers that were using that data that had to be retracted or reworked. So it wasn't just, at that point, it wasn't just in The Lancet. It was other scholarly works that had been using it.
Now, from the outside looking in, why did that take 12 years?
Oh, man. Oh, I'm going to get myself in trouble. Embarrassment, maybe, that he really fought it out long and hard.
Wakefield himself.
Yes, he did. Yeah. And has never really stepped back from that. But...
And something that we've sort of been alluding to but have not stated formally is it's clear from the way people refer to this article that it was the source of a very popular rejection of vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there have been a number of entertainment figures or, you know, popular, not scientists, obviously, but, you know, popular cultural critics who have referred to this, you know, vaccines cause autism controversy or, you know, whatever you would say if you were, much like people say evolution, no, it's just a theory and it's still being discussed, like this vaccines and autism may be connected, that kind of thing. All coming from this article and the sort of, whoa, hey, that happened mm-hmm. right after it was published.
Well, that and, I mean, he tapped into, I think, pretty common fears and not, I mean, okay, so looking at the EpiPen controversy that's exploded in the last couple of days, it's hard to love the pharmaceutical industry sometimes.
Why would you? Why would you try?
Why would you try? So it plays into people's fears about for their own children. It plays into, you know, previous controversies. He hit fertile ground.
Yeah. I am always deeply conflicted about things like this because I certainly delight in insulting corporations or trying to persuade people to be more critical of corporatization of various cultural institutions or forces, et cetera. But then also, I would like everyone to vaccinate. That's a personal opinion. Don't send me any letters. So I feel empathy for people who say, oh yeah, big pharma is pushing vaccines on us that are dangerous, because that sort of fits my kind of cultural paranoia, mm-hmm. right? But then in this case, I recognize that it's paranoia as opposed to, you know, what would you call it? Educated skepticism.
Right.
Yeah.
And, so before I came here, I worked in agriculture. So librarianship, you do everything. And what I used to tell people, kind of poking fun at this, is one of the big agricultural commodities for Georgia is, of course, peanuts. So I'd say I was a shell for Big Nut. I can't help myself.
Anthony, just shut it down. We're done. That's...
But now I'll never make that pun again, because now it's among the masses. So it's difficult. It can be really, really challenging. And it's also troubling when you don't seem to have the tools to be able to enter a conversation with the authority as well.
Right.
So you can always see your doctor and get a second opinion. I have never gotten a second opinion from my doctor. I probably should, but I don't. Or when you go into a planning session, they're like, we're going to build this bridge. And without that civil engineering, it's like, okay, you sure are going to build that bridge. I think it's troubling and difficult to accept authority just on its face value.
Yeah. So we just have a minute left, so let me give you an easy question. So how do you deal with the tension of being both a librarian who knows that we have to question authority, but then also a librarian who has to teach authority as a thing to be trusted?
Oh, how do I deal with it? I worry about it a lot. Again, beg and plead to have more interactions with students than I have. And I also try to get instructors to join in with me in this conversation about authority. Because how they construct authority, they've been in their discipline for so much longer. How they look for information is different from how we teach it. So to be able to throw out some confusion and then have an expert step in and discuss it further, those are good days. Those are the great days.
Nice. We've been talking about academic authority with Liz Holdsworth, the STEM librarian at the Georgia Tech Library.
File is set under LB1585.3.W675.
That was Not Right by the Stooges, and before that, DLZ by TV on the Radio. Songs about presenting information as is with no sugarcoating. Charlie, what's going on at the library next week?
Who am I to say? No, I'm kidding. I know what I'm talking about. Fall semester began this week, so next week should be a whirling cloud of students realizing that the work has already begun, and there's something due on Thursday, and the first test is in the third week, and how do I find the reading, and what am I going to write my paper on, and is this the right textbook, and why are the problems in the third edition all different from the fourth edition? And we will say, we are the Georgia Tech Library, and we are at your service. Look out!
Lost in the Stacks is a collaboration between WREK Atlanta and the Georgia Tech Library, produced by Amit Doshi, Charlie Bennett, Wendy Hagenmeyer, and Fred Rasko.
Anthony Woo-Woo was also our engineer today. And our show was brought to you by a journal published by some guy in a van.
Legal counsel and a 100% shockproof BS detector were provided by the Burris Intellectual Property Law Group in Atlanta, Georgia.
Special thanks to Liz for being on the show, to every librarian who has taught a class on assessing resources, and thanks, as always, to each and every one of you for listening.
And thanks, Anthony, for about 2 years of board op.
Hey, how about a round of applause for Anthony?
Yes.
Yeah!
You can hear this show again and hear Anthony's voice again. Or you can get in touch with us at wrek.org/lostinthestacks. And you can find our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, and many other podcast aggregators. Let us know if we're not on your preferred platform.
Next week on Lost in the Stacks, we're talking about the badass librarians of Timbuktu.
It's time for our last song today, and we've talked a lot about the authority of librarians today, and we're also, I'll have you know, a rock and roll radio show, and we all know at least a little something, have some authority about music. So,
where are you going with this?
Well, one of the most argued questions about music in the last 50 years is, who's better, the Beatles or the Rolling Stones?
Oh,
and
yeah,
since
of course
we all have, you know, some musical authority, I think we can all
we know
answer,
the right answer, yeah,
with some degree of authority that the answer is the Beatles.
And Fred. That is enough of that right now.
Oh.
The best rock and roll band? I mean, if you want to talk about bands, you might have a case. But rock and roll band? It's clearly the Rolling Stones.
They have a lot of great tunes. But as far as influence over generations of rock and roll...
Influence does not matter. Look, people listen to the Beatles who don't even know what rock and roll is. Sting probably still likes the Beatles.
No, wait a minute. The Beatles blew the doors open for
just because you're there
like
first doesn't mean you're better.
Like, they had the studio innovations. They had all the things...
The Rolling Stones had like the Rolling Stones.
Okay, guys... I think we need to let our guest weigh in on this.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Liz, what do you think?
Oh, Stones. Absolutely Rolling Stones.
The librarian says so.
With authority. That is definitely a respectable opinion. Okay, so I yield and leave you all, my listeners, our listeners, everyone, with respectable by the Rolling Stones.
Funny how you had that ready in your pocket.
Right here on Lost in the Stacks. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Lost in the Stacks from WREK Atlanta and the Georgia Tech Library. Find us online at wrek.org/lostinthestacks to see playlists for old shows, connect with our social media, or get in touch with us.